Thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. Yes, we'll need some Bibles. Yeah. Will you just excuse me a minute whilst I get myself sorted? Okay. Right, for those of you who don't know me, it's my name's Ian Hare, and I'm currently a pastor of a Baptist church in North Bournemouth. We've been there for nearly 9 years, Cornerstone Church, formerly West Howe Baptist Church. But a year or two ago, Judy was one of Jane and Roger's members of their youth group. If I say how long it was nearly, it'll be 26 years ago this December that Judy and I stood at the front here to get married. So that perhaps actually gives you some idea. But it's really good to be with you here this morning, and then later on this afternoon. We're going to be looking at Nehemiah chapter 5. Nehemiah's a great book. We're going to read the chapter first before we go into it. Nehemiah 5, verse 1. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. Some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." Others were saying, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, our homes to get grain during the famine." Still others were saying, "We have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others." When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered on them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, "You are exacting usury," or interest if you like, "from your own countrymen." So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, "As far as possible, we have brought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your brothers only to keep them to be sold back to us." They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. So I continued, "What you're doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain. But the exacting of usury must stop. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the usury you are charging them, the hundredth part of the money, grain, new wine, and oil." "We will give it back," they said. "We will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say." Then I summoned the priests and the maid, the nobles and the officials, take an oath to do what they had promised. I also shook out the folds of my robe and said, "In this way may God shake out of his house and possessions every man who does not keep this promise. So may such a man be shaken out and emptied." At this the whole assembly said, "Amen," and praised the Lord. And the people did as they had promised. Moreover, from the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, until this 32nd year, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate food allotted to the governor. But the earlier governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them in addition to food and wine. Their assistants also lorded it over the people. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. Instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table, as well as those who came to us from the surrounding nations. Each day, one ox, six choice sheep, and some poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days an abundant supply of wine of all kinds. In spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor, because the demands were heavy on these people. Remember me with favour, O my God, for all I have done for these people. Okay, how long have I got? What time do you finish? That's very dangerous. Okay, what do you do if you're in a pickle and you don't know where to turn? You cry out for help. A letter in the Daily Telegraph last week, man said of the trouble he was having in the local supermarket. He says, when I attempted to buy potted shrimps in the supermarket, I was surprised to be directed to the garden centre next door. Maybe they thought potted shrimps were something that grew. Who knows? Why is it that God often chooses to call his people to do things at the most impossible of times? To start building a great building project in the middle of a recession. It's not the sort of thing we would naturally think of doing. I want you just to think for a moment. Consider the following problem. There's a worldwide credit crunch, poor sales, low wages, exorbitant interest rates, excessive taxation, bankers enjoying the high life at the expense of others, the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And we're not talking about the UK in 2010, we're talking about Nehemiah, some 400 or 500 years before Christ. That is the situation that we have in this chapter. And as Nehemiah has been leading the people of Israel, following the command of the Lord to rebuild the walls around Jerusalem, so that task is exacerbating and highlighting a problem that is really affecting many people. The church in its life and mission can be, if you like, opposed or experience opposition in two ways. First of all, external opposition, which is probably what you were looking at last week with Nehemiah chapter 4. This week, it comes through internal strife. Satan will use either to try and undermine the work of God's people and the advance of the kingdom of God. But why does God allow it? Why does God allow it? Well, he allows it, as we will be seeing tonight, to help prove the genuineness of our faith and our confidence in God. He allows it perhaps to remind us that we can trust only in him, and only in him will we find truly the resources we need to face the situations before us. But also to enable us to put things right that are wrong. And when they come to the fore, that's what we need to be acting upon. It's very interesting that if you read through this chapter carefully, you see there's a lot of links with a situation that happened in the early life of the church in Acts chapter 6, where there was a problem of food distribution amongst the widows in the early church, and the disputes that arose then, and how the apostles responded to it. So as we have a look at this chapter, I want us to see some of the principles that we can learn whereby, as the Lord's people, we face up to and deal with difficult issues that arise in the life and the work of the church. So, no? Where are we? The other one? That one? Ah, right. Okay. First of all, we need to face the grievance. Many years ago, when we were on holiday as a family in Cornwall, we saw a lad stuck a teenage lad stuck on the cliffs above Mullion Cove on the Lizard Peninsula. He had started climbing down the cliffs, got himself well and truly stuck, couldn't go up, couldn't go down, and he was screaming for help. This was before the mobile phones were readily available, so somebody had to run to a call box to phone for the air sea rescue. It wasn't, of course, Prince William that came to rescue him. That was long before Prince William's time, but he was rescued. But he was crying out in desperation. And here in verse 1, we read, "Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry," and it literally means a cry of desperation, of despair, of distress. It's the same word that expressed the cry of the people of Israel when they arrived at the Red Sea with Pharaoh hot on their tail. What are we going to do? Where are we going to turn? What lies, though, behind their cry? Well, first of all, there were widespread food shortages. The landowners were having to mortgage their food and the land to buy food. That is desperation. In a credit crunch, we know that many people have to give up at times their homes. But to have to mortgage your home just to get food for your table, you realise things really are desperate. We see in verse 4, the people were having to borrow money at exorbitant interest rates to pay high taxes. Now, these weren't taxes imposed within Judah by the Israeli leadership there. These were the taxes that were imposed by King Artaxerxes, the emperor of the Persian Empire, to which they were subject. But nevertheless, the Jewish leaders were exacerbating the problem by making a few quick bucks by high interest rates. And as a result, children were being sold into slavery. And perhaps rubbing salt into wound, it was the fact that it was their own people that were bringing about these injustices. "Now men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers." Steve Turner has written the poem, "Why the Rich Need the Poor." He says, "If you want to keep going up in the world, you need someone to stand on." Now that's the way of the world, but it shouldn't be the way of the Lord's people. But that's what's happening here. And let's just think for a few moments of the impact that was making in this particular situation. We see that, first of all, the people were feeling as though they were second-class citizens. They say in verse 5, "Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery." Every human being has been made in the image of God. All of the Lord's people, whoever we are, whatever background we're from, have been called and redeemed by him. We have equal value and equal status before him. No one has a greater position than another. It's a level playing field. But because of the way certain members of God's people were acting, others were being trampled upon, and it left them feeling as though they were second-class citizens. And that can happen at times within the church. We have seen highlighted in the press just recently with the Pope's visit to this country some of the feelings that are expressed by those who experience abuse. We may be very critical of that, but we need to be very careful, because in any church, in any situation, there can be problems which occur, leaving people, certain people, to feel as though they are second-class citizens. And as a result of that, they were feeling powerless. "Some of our daughters," verse 5, "have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. They couldn't help themselves. Their sense of self-respect and self-esteem had been taken from them. They had no sense of dignity. It was being robbed from them. But not only did this have an effect on the people, it had an effect on the work of God. The workers were distracted. How many people can undertake heavy manual labour in rebuilding a wall if they've had no food to eat? Not only that, we see that the work was disabled because people are being enslaved and therefore not able to serve in the work. And therefore the work is drying up. The greatest resource in the Lord's kingdom are the Lord's people. And if they are distracted by issues such as this, then the Lord's work is inevitably affected. And then it has an impact on the outside world. Further down in verse 9, we read that they say there, it is affecting their witness to their neighbours. Other people see. They see what goes on. They look at our lives. They look at who we are as God's people. And they see and they know. We can't pull the wool over their eyes. If there are issues that we're not facing up to and dealing with, they know that. They see it. And they see the gap between what we profess and how we live our lives. As I say, we'll think more on that this evening. But as the famous Methodist minister W.E. Sangster once said, are some people outside the Church of Christ because of the way we live inside it? Okay, so what is the way forward with that? Well, it's putting the wrong right, and we see that in verses 6 to 19. I love that little phrase that comes in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe when the four children are at the Beaver's house, and Mr. Beaver tells them of the coming of Aslan, the Christ-like figure who's going to come and deliver his people from the bondage they're in. And he says this, wrong shall be right when Aslan comes in sight. At the sound of his roar, sorrows will be no more. When he bares his teeth, winter meets its death. And when he shakes his mane, we shall have spring again. Do you realise that the whole of Christian theology and ethics can be summed up in two questions? All of the works of Augustine, Irenaeus, Athanasius, Anselm, Calvin, Luther, Jonathan Edwards, you name it, all summed up in two simple questions. What kind of God and so what? Yeah? What kind of God do we have and so what? What does that mean for our lives? And in verse 9, Nehemiah sums up the basis of his actions. He says, shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God? Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God? This is the foundation to Nehemiah's response. Our attitude towards God will influence the way we act and react towards one another within the Lord's people and those outside it. And vice versa. What did not Jesus say in the parable in Matthew 25? As much as you did it to one of these, the least of my brethren, you did it as unto me. So, what should we do? Well, there's two possible responses someone can make when these awkward issues arise. The first one is to try and ignore it. And that, unfortunately, has often been the way with the church throughout history. Almost like a child. You know how children, when they've done something wrong and they feel awkward and embarrassed and they cover their eyes with their hands. And then because they can't see you, they think you can't see them. It doesn't make the problem go away, does it? It doesn't resolve anything. Or we can face up to and deal with the matters. You know how many youngsters wear these wrist straps? WWJD, what would Jesus do? It's a good question to ask, but it's not always an easy one to answer, is it? In reality. Because often situations are very complex. But nevertheless, we see here Nehemiah gives a very clear response that involves his heart, his mind, and his will. So we have a response with his heart. We read in verse 6, "When I heard that outcry and these charges, I was very angry." Sorry, am I making something click here? Sorry? All right. It's the way of saying it's had enough of me. Lovely, thank you. Okay, so his response is first of all with his heart. He is angry. Now, some anger, of course, can be very negative, particularly if it's towards someone or a group of people that have hurt us and we won't forgive them or deal with the issues behind that hurt. But this is an example of righteous anger. The same anger that Jesus showed on occasions when he looked with distress in the synagogue as the Pharisees were far more concerned about the obedience to their interpretation of the Sabbath laws than they were to see a man with a withered arm being healed. It was the anger he showed in the temple when he cleared out the money changers and swept them aside because of the abuse they were making of the temple and those who worshipped there. So his first response is this righteous anger. And it's a powerful tool because it's a motivating tool. It's looking at injustice and saying, that is wrong. We must do something about it. But something must also happen before action takes place. And Nehemiah does that. He acts also with his mind. Verse 7, I pondered them in my mind. The word there means to contemplate, to think seriously about this. Anger may be an appropriate response, but it's not the only response we need. The danger of just acting out of anger is that we act in a very emotive way, which can also be very destructive. Another way of interpreting verse 7 here is that Nehemiah says, I mastered my feelings. I put them in check and thought things through. How are we going to deal with this matter? What should I do? And then in the light of that, he acts with his will, calling together a public meeting. Now, not all issues can be addressed out in the public, but this was a widespread one. Everyone knew about it. Therefore, it had to be dealt with out in the open. It had to be dealt with in a way that would be even-handed, where everyone could see what was going on and where everyone would know that justice had been done in resolving with it. And because he acts in this manner, Nehemiah is able to elicit this effective response, this widespread commitment and oath of those who have acted wrongly to put it right. So here we see Nehemiah's response. But there's something even more important that comes out of this chapter than just these principles. It's the way that Nehemiah acts himself, leading by example. There was a job application for a particular job in the States which asked this, have you ever been arrested? And one respondent replied, no. To the next question, why not? He wrote, because I've never been caught. Now, one of the key ingredients in leadership and particularly in Christian leadership, must be integrity. Calvert Roberts, a US industrialist and motivational speaker, says this: if my people understand me, I'll get their attention. If my people trust me, I'll get their action. And that's what Nehemiah needs. He needs action, and therefore he has to live by example, just as Christ did. No, Jesus, not even his enemies could get mud to stick upon him. And finally, when he was put to death, it was on trumped up charges. So we see here five elements to Nehemiah's integrity. First of all, he forsook the privileges of leadership. Previous governors of Judah had been entitled to receive huge quantities of food and drink and money to go with their office. And Nehemiah doesn't simply lighten the load, he removes it altogether. Now, within the church setting, we know that it's fully right, as Paul reminds us in 1 Corinthians 9 and 1 Timothy 5, that those who are called to ministry within the church should be supported properly by the church. But there are times when we should, as leaders, perhaps not hold on to our privileges because of the needs elsewhere. So, for example, on a trivial example, as a Baptist pastor, I receive an annual book allowance, which is very helpful in the ministry that I have, and also because I'm currently studying to do a master's degree. But in a time of severe austerity, if the church is in great need and other people were going without, then surely the first thing should go would be the book allowance. So, he forsook his privileges. He has a reverence for God. Verse 15, out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. If the people of God are called to live a life that honours God, as they are, then that should be seen first and foremost in the lifestyle of the leaders, shouldn't it? Yeah? Bishop Wallace Benn, the Bishop of Lewis, I think it is, tells the story of meeting the teenage son of a well-known Christian leader in this country. And the teenager commented to Wallace Benn this. He said, "The trouble with my dad is that he's a street saint and a house devil. He appears so wonderful outside, not so wonderful inside." We have to lead by example, and Nehemiah does that because of his reverence for God. The Lord is the Lord over every aspect of his life. But also, he refuses to be distracted from his prime task of building the wall. This issue has arisen and he deals with it. But it doesn't mean that it's a step backwards. By dealing with it, it actually is a launch forward in seeing the project on to completion. And that is a vital step that we have to take. He was also generous in his own giving. And then finally, we see his prayer for grace. Remember me with favour, O God, for all I have done for these people. We cannot be saved by the things we do, but we are saved to serve the Lord. And here Nehemiah is praying that God will receive the way he lives, the way he has handled this situation, as a token of his worship and service to God that will be acceptable by him. And there is an echo of this in the whole response to this situation. For finally, we see the people of God are set free to do the work that God has called them to. The work of God advances. And their worship and our worship, if we follow these principles, will become a glorious sound of victory, as it should be. You know, there's nothing more painful to listen to, is there, than someone playing on a badly out of tune instrument. It's a jarring note. It sounds uncomfortable. We don't want to be in the same room. You know how it is, perhaps, with a young person learning to play the violin. Or my daughter and her husband used to live in a flat below a chap who was practicing the trumpet, often late at night. It was painful. We were there. It's a jarring note. Well, in his case, it was a lot of jarring notes. Almost every note was a jarring note. And when the church fails to address an issue that is badly affecting the life of its people, it sends out a jarring note. But when it prepared to do what Nehemiah did and face up to it, face it straight on and deal with it, then it offers up a great note of praise. As we read in verse 13, the whole assembly said, "Amen." And they praised the Lord. Thank you.